Thanks for listening to this Word in Your Ear podcast. If you'd like to get early access to all our productions ad-free, priority booking for our live events, and to take part in our weekly quiz, go to patreon.com/wordinyourear for more details.
You're listening to a podcast from the
John,
Word.
It's very nice to see you. I suppose the first question is, well, Dire Straits sort of dissolved in around 1995. So why did you not write the book earlier?
I wasn't asked to.
Oh, right. So somebody asked you. It wasn't a question of you just jumping at the bit and thinking, I've got to tell this story.
No, it never really came up in conversation. I just found myself sitting next to a very nice lady from Peter Fraser Dunlop. At some charity event in my local hometown down in the New Forest. And she turned to me during supper and she said, have you ever thought about writing a book? And I said, this is a very strange question. Why do you ask? And she said, well, I saw one of your shows recently where I talk about the history of the band and play some of the old songs in a chronological sort of form. And she said, I found it very interesting. I think you could write a good story about that. I think people would find it fascinating. And I said, oh, God, I can't be bothered to do that. And she said, well, if you think about it, and if you like the idea, then come and see me. So anyway, I got another phone call from her saying, are you going to come and see me or not? And eventually I ended at the offices and talking to her, and one thing led to another, and here we are.
Well, this book starts in, I think you brought up, was in Market Harborough?
I did, in Leicestershire, yeah.
Give us some idea of we might even ask for the old traditional question, Dave. The record playing equipment.
Yeah, can you remember what record playing equipment there was in your home? We're trying to find out whether it was a posh radiogram or a tiny Dan set or whatever.
At that particular point in time, at the age of 13, I didn't have a record player at all. Mm-hmm. I know it sounds kind of strange. We were listening to Radio Luxembourg on a crystal radio set. At night time, when my brother and I were supposed to be asleep, Will and I would tune into Radio Luxembourg because people were talking about it at school. You got to tune into it. So
he built
this crystal radio set. Yeah, and we had these old-fashioned headphones that my dad used in the war.
Oh, really?
You know, so we listened. We each had one, you know, ear each. So we was listening, and sort of Elvis was coming down the signal and Chuck Berry and all this, and I thought, what is this? This is kind of exciting. It made me feel something. And I suppose being in a sort of middle class Victorian background in Leicestershire, it was, if you like, devoid of a little bit of emotional content, to put it kindly. And this music was a sort of language that I didn't really understand, but it touched me very deeply. And still does, so, you know, that's what turned me on to getting involved in music at all. And so I, you know, eventually saved up some money to buy a guitar and struggled with it for endless hours trying to make some decent sound out of it.
So you didn't have mates who played or anything at that stage, you were pretty much doing it on your own?
Well, it turned out that this was happening to a few other people around me, so we eventually ended up in one of the rooms in my house, much to my parents' despair, where there's thrashing around and making the most filthy noise on these cheap guitars. And we built all our own equipment. We built speaker cabinets and we bought these little horrible little amplifiers from somewhere and we plugged them all in and, you know, fused the house and all the rest of it. And I think so at some point somebody used a radio set to manage to get a plug into a radio set so they could get some sound out of it. It was desperate times. And it probably sounded absolutely dreadful, but we were having a ball just trying to copy what was coming down the airwaves.
And who did you talk very excitedly about two records that really changed your life. Well, I think one was I Can't Explain by the Who.
Yeah.
And the other was the Kinks, It's You Really Got Me. So what was it about those two that were so explosive and exciting?
Well, I'm not sure I have to explain that. If anybody's ever heard them, I mean, you hear that. I mean, would it be great to write that, you know, even now? And they were just classic 2.5 minute moments of joy to me. It was like, oh, my God. And when I got to see The Who, when I was, I don't know, 16 or something, I mean, boy, that was a moment.
Did you ever go through the stage of pretend to be a musician by, you know, posing with a tennis racket in front of a dressing room, a dressing table mirror or anything like that?
Well, before you go on stage, that's what you always do. Oh, right. You find a mirror and check it. I'm joking. Yeah, there's a little bit about that, a little bit of that. You know.
Right, right.
There's a bit of posing, but of course, when you're that young, you don't really put it all together. It's only when you look back on it, this is why it was interesting writing the book and looking back on it, why, how all these things fitted together and how you ended up on that sort of trajectory, if you like, into something else. Yeah, I think.
What was the material you played in the school group? You were in a school group and you talk about that.
We've got a picture of them here, actually.
Was it the Knot? I can't remember.
Yeah, that was a Paul McCartney, I call it a Paul McCartney Hofta bass, you know, which I borrowed off somebody at school who couldn't play it. It's not my first guitar. My brother, who's in the middle there, Will, who's playing a Watkins Rapier. I don't know if you remember those. They were about 22 quid, I think. And I borrowed that guitar because my brother initially, when I joined the band, made me a bass in the woodwork shop. I mean, how the hell do you make a guitar? But he was amazing at making things. And it looked a bit like a spade, so it was called the Spade. And I've no idea what happened to it. It disappeared somewhere.
So what kind of stuff did you do?
Well, we were playing things like Nadine by Chuck Berry and Don't Let Me Be Misunderstood, a few Beatles things. We pretty much got away with it. You know, this was a place called Routh Hall, which was where we used to show a film on a Saturday night in this sort of rather primitive public school, which I went to. And so we used to play on a Saturday night and rap out a few tunes for the boys. They loved it, and we loved it. I mean, we were thought we were the bee's knees. You know.
Well, rock music must have seemed even more exciting and rebellious at this school, because you described the school as being the kind of place where you got expelled if you were caught reading Lady Chatterley's Lover. Is that right?
Actually, I was beaten mercilessly by my housemaster for reading Dr. No by Ian Fleming.
Wow. God, you're kidding.
Yeah, he said, you cannot read this sexual rubbish. And I went, oh, I thought, God, there's not much of that in there, is it? I'm just pretty tame. Compared to today, it's pretty tame. But anyway, yeah, that was. They used to mete out punishments for very little in those days. Yeah, pretty severe.
So is it fair to say, just moving on, that after you left school, you had a long period of kind of drifting, didn't you, really?
I had a couple of years of drifting, because I left school with very few qualifications. I got art A level, a decent level of art A level, but I didn't have much else apart from an ability to play the guitar a bit.
Right.
So in those days, you couldn't really get a job unless you had, you know, 3 A levels at least. Yeah. You couldn't go to university, so that was out. And so I drifted around for a couple of years, and then somebody then gave me a job in a timber yard down in South East London.
And that's where you met David Knopfler, is that right? And then no, you started living in a flat together?
No, well, I worked at this timber firm for about 3 years, and then I decided I wanted to go back to university because I wanted to prove to myself that I wasn't a bloody idiot, you know, because having no qualifications at all. So I actually went to evening classes to get enough qualifications to get into London University, which I did at Goldsmiths College in South London. Little did I know that was an art college at the time. I did sociology there for 3 years, and that's when I moved into the council flat, because they were offering students these council flats for very little money, although it seemed a lot at the time, £9.50 a week for a 4-bedroom flat. But each bedroom was about a size of this, and I couldn't afford the rent, so David Knopfler appeared as my flatmate. And, you know, then, of course, David brought Mark into the situation.
So you talk about feeling connected to him.
Yeah.
Immediately through various records. And he liked, I think it was J.J. Cale, Rykuda, and Little Feet.
Yeah.
And describe your first impressions of meeting him.
Well, he's, how can I put it simply? I mean, as soon as I met him, I felt that I was going to know him for a long time. He had a very general sort of northern Geordie sort of warmth about him. He was very sort of understated. He was lying on the concrete floor in the flat when I came in early one morning after misbehaving all night. And I made him a cup of tea. And, of course, my first impressions of him was that he was lying there with a guitar over his chest. He'd fallen asleep on the concrete floor with his head in the sofa. And I looked at him, I thought, yeah, that's definitely Mark, because he's had Dave's features, you know. We had a cup of tea and started chatting, and I thought, I quite like you. So we immediately struck up a friendship, and then we went and had breakfast down at the Star Cafe in Deptford High Street. And that's really cemented it, that breakfast, and we chatted away, talked about music endlessly, discovered we had the same thread, if you like, which was interesting. We were exactly the same age, so we'd kind of gone through almost exactly the same clear view of how we wanted to fit into that world. So it was a shared moment, really. And
he was very accomplished from early on. I mean, I can remember first hearing Mark Knopfler and thinking, good grief, you know.
Yeah, like
you know, there didn't seem to be a kind of gauche, you know, apprentice period. No. He could do it straight away. That must have struck you.
Well, it did. I mean, he'd obviously played a lot before I'd met him. And as I say in the book, he had this really extraordinary sort of picking style, which I hadn't heard before, which was a bit of rock, bit of jazz, bit of country. A bit of everything, really, and he'd obviously worked it out for himself, because I hadn't heard anybody else play like that. And when I picked up the bass and started playing with him, we just sort of locked in like that straight away, and it was quite interesting, because that hadn't happened with another guitarist I can remember like that. So there was no frustration of being how are we going to play together. It was just automatic, and which was rather delightful, actually.
So clearly you thought right at the beginning, this is going to go multi-platinum. We're out of Deptford, you know.
We're quids in.
This is going to happen. Yeah. What were your ambitions at that point?
To be able to afford breakfast, pretty much. Right. I don't think you really, you have your dreams, don't you, when you're younger. But when you get a bit older, and by this time I was 26 years old when we met, and so was he. So dreams weren't kind of fantasies anymore. There was a sense of reality. It was like, okay, we sound good together here. And then David played the guitar a bit, so he joined in. And then we needed a drummer. And then when Pick Withers comes on the scene, I suddenly realised that actually this is quite special, because Pick really was the only professional musician amongst us. He'd been earning a living, kind of, for years with different bands, as you know. And although we still had to pay for his petrol and his fag money when he came down, he insisted on that for a while.
Did Mark have an idea of what he wanted the group to sound like? Did he ever say, this is the particular sound I'm looking for?
No, he didn't have to say that, because it was sounding the way it sounded. And the sound that we created very early on was the sound that you hear on the first album, but obviously much more, you know, organised and slightly more controlled and all the rest of it. But that was, when we sat down together, that was the sound we made. It wasn't kind of like, we should try and sound like this or sound like that. Because if you remember, the world was full of punk music then, and you mentioned that Slaughter and the Dogs thing there.
That was a
very interesting evening, to say the least.
Yeah, we're going to get onto that in a moment.
Okay, but you know, I think that was the sound of the band almost immediately. I mean, I felt like I'd played with Pick for years.
Yeah.
That was interesting, you know, and I just thought, okay, this works. And I thought, this could be interesting.
But yeah. When you read about your getting a record deal, it's unbelievable how fast it happened, because you'd had a record shop called Honky Tonk, and you'd written to Charlie Gillett, and Charlie Gillett written back to you. So you then sent him a demo tape. Did you explain what happened there? Because it was extraordinary.
Well, when we made the demo tape, which was done with some money that my granny had left us, or left me, and Mark said to me, do you know Charlie Gillett, don't you? And I said, well, I don't really know Charlie Gillett. I mean, he helped me put some records in the record shop. But and he said, "Well, do you think we can get the tape to him?" And I said, "Well, we can try." So I rang Radio London and left a message for Charlie, and he rang back and said, "You know, come round to my flat on Thursday, my house in Clapham on Friday and Thursday afternoon, and drop the tape off." I was like, "Okay." And this is a major DJ, by the way. I don't know whether you remember Charlie Gillett, but this was a major DJ on the radio on Sunday mornings, which everybody, all the record company people used to listen to. And so we had tea and biscuits with Charlie, which is very, he was a lovely man, and we got on very well with him, and gave him the tape. He said, "I won't listen to it now, I'll listen to it later." So I said, "Fine." We walked out. And damn me if he didn't play it on the radio that Sunday, 2 days, 3 days later. And then the phone started ringing.
Because you didn't actually hear it on the radio, did you?
No.
People got in touch, said they're playing you on the radio.
Well, we were, Mark and I were moving furniture that day on a Sunday because to earn a few quid for a friend. And so we walked in the pub, you know, on the council estate where we used to go and have beers and stuff in the evenings. And everybody went, "Whoa, Charlie played the record, you know, on the radio today." We went, "What?"
Really? And immediately there's a bidding war. I mean, there's three or four major labels, aren't there?
Yes, it got a bit sort of mad, and thankfully I mentioned the age thing because if we'd been 18, we probably would have, you know, gone a bit
really bonkers. Good point.
It would have been very difficult for us to deal with all that energy at that time. Yes, there was a bit of a bidding war, and some of the bids were quite interesting, as I mentioned in the book, with, you know, with Mr. Branson and stuff like that in the early days of Virgin.
Yes, you were taken out by a load of attractive girls. That's right.
Well, they all turned out to be working with Virgin because, yeah, you know, Richard did like to have attractive girls around him, as we know, and he still does. So, I mean, that's nothing. Nothing's changed there. But, and I'll just tell this little story because it's quite funny. He invited us out after he'd sent a sort of a rough estimate of his deal to our lawyer, which we had to get a lawyer to deal with all this stuff. And it wasn't a very good deal. Anyway, he said, "Come out for supper tonight, you know, on this week." So we all went out to this Greek restaurant just off, I think it's down in Notting Hill somewhere. And we walked in, we sat in this private room, and in between all of us, each of us, was a very, very pretty girl. And so Mark and I looked at each other across the table and went, "Mm-hmm, okay." And then the owner of the restaurant walked in with a tray full of joints. Right, so we started. Everybody got slightly stoned, if you can imagine, and there was sort of hands under the table on people's legs and such like going on. I was thinking, "Oh my God, this is getting really kind of weird here." And Richard was saying, "Aren't we having a great time? You know, come and sign with us. You're going to have a really good.
Just put your name with
everything's going to be wonderful." And Mark and I looked across at the table as you threw and went, "Uh huh." So I think being a bit older, we could handle that kind of stuff.
So you signed to Phonogram instead.
Didn't he
lay a hand on you?
Didn't Richard Branson say afterwards that was the night I lost $1 billion or something?
Well, there was an article I don't know if it was the Sun or the Mirror or something, and somebody sent it to me, and I thought, "Oh my God, fancy admitting that."
Yeah.
Because, the day I gave away $1 billion, or £1 billion or something. Because that would have been basically what the record company would have probably made. A bit more than us, I have to say.
Yeah, right. Yeah. But your ascent was so rapid. The first gig you played, I think, was at a punk festival. And the second was at the Bandstand and Clapham Common to 2,000 people. Is that right? So that was your second gig.
As you can see how organised we are, I was facing the audience. I mean, that was... The first gig was in front of probably 20 or 30... inebriated members of the Crossfields estate where we lived between the railway line and our flat, and with a big wind blowing. And the next one was in front of 2,000 people on Clapham Common. I was completely freaked out by that, the sight of all those people. I mean, we were just hamming it along, really. Well, you can see there's one at the bottom here. I mean, yeah, God, I don't know how we got away with it, actually. But we did. And Charlie was quite keen to sign the band, but he could see there was an awful lot of... Because he had a record label called Oval Records.
Oval Records,
yeah. Yeah, you remember that, yeah. And they used to sign people, but I think he realised the energy that was coming at us was much more than he could handle, really.
But there were quite a few people in the British record business at the time who thought, this is going to be huge. And then the reason they thought that is they thought America will love this.
Yeah.
And this was a time when lots of the bands being signed by British record companies America didn't love. I mean, were you aware of this at the time?
Not really, to be honest. Getting a deal when there was a lot of punk music around was quite interesting. But there were bands like us just playing, you know, normal rock and roll music, you know, pub bands and such like, which was great. But, signing with Phonogram, I think, put us into a position where we felt confident that they were going to take care of us. They said, if you sell 5,000 copies of the first album, we'll be very happy. Very happy. And then we got a phone call from Holland. They got a phone call from Holland saying we've sold 25,000 copies.
In Holland? Yeah,
just in Holland.
I know. It was like, what?
I know.
Anyway, and then America picked up on it. And
yeah.
And it's very rare, actually. I can only say this in retrospect. It's very rare for America to pick up on something like that so quickly.
Mm.
And most Americans thought we were an American band.
Yeah. Yeah.
So when we were to do interviews, they said, oh, gee, yeah, we thought you were American.
Yeah.
He went, no, we're from Southeast London, actually.
Yeah. There's a lovely story about Ed Bicknell, the guy who comes on to marry you.
To marry you.
He did ask, and I turned him down, actually.
To manage you. And obviously, it made a huge difference to the band, you know. But tell us the story about when you first met him and went to have that meeting with him.
Oh, my God. Well, he wanted to impress us. He was working for NEMS Agency at that particular point, which was, as probably you might remember, was a little dodgy. But he was a booking agent for them, and he was booking people like Talking Heads, which is the reason why we went on the Talking Heads tour. Mark and I went for a meeting with him, and because he'd already been to Dingwalls to see us. And the first thing he did when he walked into Dingwalls was knock over Mark's red Strat in the dressing room. Well, that was a really good start, you know. So they got... Anyway, Mark and I went to see him at the agency, and he was behind this big mahogany desk and all, you know, big, unimportant sort of thing. So we sat there thinking, oh, okay, this is rather nice office and all this. And he said, let's chat, you know. I've told them not to let any phone calls through at all, because we need to get serious about this. I want to manage this band, and I want you to do this tour with Talking Heads and all this bit. The phone starts ringing, right? I've told you, I don't care if it's Brian Ferry, put the phone And Mark and I, okay, right then. And then a bit more chat.
It's out of a movie, isn't it?
It is, ridiculous. And the phone rings 3 minutes later. I don't want to be disturbed. This is, I'm in a very important meeting. I don't care, I'll call you back later. This went on for about half an hour. And in there we said, can you just tell them to stop running through? Anyway, the story was basically he said, just keep phoning me to make look like him.
It was the receptionist, wasn't it? Saying it.
That old trick. But anyway.
But it's very rare. In your book, you actually say it's kind of, he managed Dire Straits all the way through.
Yeah.
And he was immensely, hugely valuable. You know, because normally people say, well, the manager, you know, we succeeded despite the manager. It tends to say, you don't say that at all. You really give him his due.
Well, I think he deserves the due. I mean, he grew with us. That's the fact. And his mentor was Peter Grant from Led Zeppelin, of course. You know, so he saw the way Peter Grant operated. And, of course, when the band started getting successful, it gave him more credibility, more power. And he enjoyed that. He enjoyed going to the record company and saying, you're not going to get another record unless you increase the royalty rate and walk out, you know. And, you know, he used that power very well. But he was a very, very good manager. And, you know, of course there's times when you get, you know, everything gets a bit fractured and all the rest of it. You know, disagree about certain things. But that's normal. But overall, I stressed in the book that he was very good for the band. And we were very good for him. I mean, he got a lot of credibility from managing Dire Straits, and he did a damn good job of it.
We couldn't resist including this. This is, we're looking at a bill from the Hope and Anchor for December in whatever year this is, and meal ticket have actually sold out, but Dire Straits, who spelled with the GHT have not sold
still
out.
Still got a few of their £1 tickets to be taken up.
Yeah.
Competing with Deke Leonard's Deke Iceberg Leonard's and the X-Ray Specs. What are your memories of the kind of the pub circuit in London at that time?
Well, I've got to tell you, I still get emails from people who spell the name like that.
Really?
Unbelievable after all these years. It's incredible, isn't it?
Didn't really
well, yeah. Anyway, but you have to forgive them for that because we were quite new to the scene. Well, I just remember the Hope and Anchor. You must remember playing. You're going down there.
I've never played the Hope.
Oh, you haven't? Okay, yeah. Well, you might one day. But anyway, yeah. So, yes, well, it's about, let's be generous, it's about another half size bigger than this.
Yes, it is.
And if you can imagine 120 people in there, no air conditioning, no windows, everybody's smoking.
Yes,
that's right.
Everybody's smoking.
Yeah. Eating chips.
And a stage which is probably lower, a bit lower than this. And, yeah, it was pretty intense. We had no roadies in those days, so we used to have to load everything in through the beer chute.
Yes, it did.
And for some reason, it was Mark and me that was loading the bloody stuff in and out. I don't know where Pick and David were, but they were always conveniently not around. And of course, you try lifting a bass bin out of a beer chute after you've been playing in front of 120 people, absolutely drenched in sweat, for about £20 and a pint.
But it very quickly grew, and you played a huge amount of gigs, didn't you? I mean, how busy were your busiest?
Oh, well,
there's one bit where you talk about playing 246 shows in 1 year, I think, in 23 different countries. Would that be right?
I think, well, the Brothers in Arms tour, I think, was 248 shows in, I don't know how many countries it was. But the On Every Street tour was about the same number of shows, slightly more, but to three times as many people, 7 million people. No, 7.5 million people in a year and a half.
Absolutely astonishing.
Mad. I mean, when you say to bands now, you're going on tour, they say, yeah, we're doing 30 dates.
Yes.
And they're going,
yes.
Well, you're just warming up then, are you?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Yeah. And when you come off a tour like that, is it that kind of cliche where at 8 o'clock at night you just feel, you know, that you're meant to be doing a sound check and the adrenaline just kicks in? I mean, is it?
Yeah, well, you feel a bit weird, actually.
Yeah.
You feel weird because suddenly all that structure around you is gone and you've exchanged one family, this big touring family, which is like an army on manoeuvres, and you go back home and there's your wife or girlfriend and a child or something you haven't seen for probably 6 months or something, and you can't order a taxi, you can't get a plane ticket, you don't know how to book a restaurant, you don't know how to do anything.
Yeah.
You don't even know how to carry your own bag, which is pathetic, really, but because when you're in that sort of situation, you've got everybody looking after you.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's very, very spoiling. But it's kind of necessary. If you're playing 248 shows, you don't want to be carrying your own bag. Yeah. And washing your own clothes and getting your own cab. You've got to have somebody doing it for you, or you can't do it.
But do you find you're kind of stranded between the two lives? I've talked to loads of musicians who say, when I'm on tour, I want to be at home. When I'm at home, I want to be on tour.
I don't know. I'm not sure I think like that. I saw it as two very separate things, which, of course, inevitably leads to problems. I do go into that in the book because it is very difficult to keep relationships going, and I think anybody who's in a successful rock and roll band finds that, because your sense of proportions and perspective gets sort of shattered by this, you know, walking on stage every night and getting that adrenaline rush.
Yes.
And you doesn't come home and that adrenaline rush isn't there anymore.
So,
you know,
abnormal.
Going out for a meal isn't exactly the same as standing on stage in front of 30,000 people. Really.
No, there's a bit at the end of Dire Straits, we're jumping forward here, but where you talk about having to learn to be an adult all over again because you just...
That's pathetic, isn't it, really?
You haven't done any washing up, can't remember how to make a bed or whatever, you know.
Darling, I've forgotten how to wash up. Oh, yeah, really?
Yeah.
Let's just talk about some of the people that you know, your success brought you into contact with. But, you know, the second album, is it the second album, Communique, is made with... the legendary Jerry Wexler, The Atlantic. So you've made the first record kind of pretty much quite quickly, haven't you? You're quite a modest budget. And then suddenly second record, you're where are you, Bahamas or whatever, and, you know, legendary producer.
And they're flying lobsters and steaks in from the mainland every day.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, absolutely unbelievable. How did that feel, just that, the amount of success?
Well, that felt very weird because we were still living in the council flat and Jerry Wexler was not going to slum it, I can tell you. Not being the senior vice president of Warner Brothers, he wasn't going to slum it. So he hired this house, which was just absurd. It was owned by some widow of an oil tycoon, you know, with columns and swimming pools and... ballet studios and God knows what, grand pianos and big fluffy white carpets and blue sea and all of this. It's like, my God, I mean, you can see it here, look. It was that lovely tall bloke on the left-hand side. Oh, listen. that's, you know, the house is where I'm sitting here now. I mean, that was the view. Can you imagine coming into that and then going to work, you know? But Jerry was a very safe pair of hands, but he... was very well aware of how much the first album was being received in America and going down. Because when we were there, I think the album was really starting to motor in the States. So he had this idea that he thought, right, I'm going to make a record that's the same as that first record. So that was his intention, to try and keep that sound together. So there's a similarity in A, approach, and B, in the sound of it. Despite the fact that the equipment that we were supposed to fly in from Miami to use on the album never turned up. But anyway, that's another story. You have to buy the book to learn about all this stuff. And Jerry was, he flew in his food, all the food for us from New York, from his bakery and from the butchers. And he and I used to go down to the airport and pick up these big aluminium cases of food.
Lobster.
Unbelievable. Well, actually, the lobsters came from the island.
Oh,
well,
that's all right.
And that was the one thing that did come from the island.
Every day you're getting calls saying that the first album is just...
Yeah, it's starting to motor, yeah. So that was all good news. And, he was great to work with, I have to say. But Barry Beckett, his engineer, I've got to give a lot of credit to Barry, because he was the Muscle Shoals, part of the Swampers in Muscle Shoals. Yeah, you know, the rhythm section that played on Aretha's albums and all the rest of it.
Yeah. Yeah.
He was a fabulous guy to work with.
But you went from kind of penury to the kind of the first class lounge pretty quickly, didn't you?
Yeah. And you basically have to get used to a lot of things that you're not used to. I mean, the landscape is changing very quickly that you're in. So you have to learn how to deal with it. It's coming at you really thick and fast. So it helped being a bit older as well, I think, you know. Mm-hmm. And, I mean, when you get the confidence of an album hitting America, that has a kind of a fairly significant effect on you.
Yeah.
And we didn't really want to do Communique quite so quickly because it has just started. It was taking off in America and it was just starting to really take off in Europe. So we didn't really need another album out, to be frank. We needed to keep that first album going and go touring. But Warner Brothers put huge amounts of pressure on us, and Ed was having real difficulty dealing with it. Ed Bicknell. So he had to say, I can't deal with Warner Brothers. They're just going to go ahead with this thing anyway.
Mm.
And that's what happened.
So moving forward, the two members of the original group left.
Uh-huh.
I mean, not together or anything, but David Knopfler, obviously Mark's brother, and Pick Withers, the drummer. Pick, he just didn't want to do it anymore. He wanted to be in Weather Report, doesn't he? Is that what he says in the book?
Yes. Well, that was partly what he said, but I think he was just getting... He was finding it physically very difficult as a drummer to play all those shows. And I can see that very clearly now. At the time, I thought he was handling it pretty well, but I think he just needed to back off from it. He'd kind of had enough, I think.
Right.
And, you know, you can sense when somebody is beginning to build up to a problem. And he made the album, he made Love of a Gold with us, and then We sat and had lunch with him, Mark and I, one day, and we were wondering why did he Pick doesn't usually ask to have a meeting with Mark and I. You know, it just doesn't usually happen, especially when we're paying for lunch. But anyway, he just suddenly announced, you know, I'm going to leave the band. It was like, oh, right, we've just made the record, Pick, and we're going to go on tour. The tour's booked. Are you not going to do the tour with us? I mean, you've got the record, and you know. And he said, no, I can't fit. I don't want to. I've had enough. I can't do it anymore.
Mm. What were the circumstances of David leaving then?
Well, I think, you know, I think we can all recognise situations where brothers working in a very intense relationship like that. They're very different kinds of people, David yeah. and Mark. I mean, the thing is, I was friends with both of them, so it was very tricky for me, I have to say. But that was building up as well. I mean, David was David was finding success quite difficult to deal with. And I suppose some people do, and he did. Mark and I really enjoyed it. I mean, we enjoyed the fact that we were successful. David was saying,
why did he find it difficult?
I don't know. He was saying things like, I'm not sure it was meant to be like this. And it was like, well, what's this meant to be like? You know, third on the bill to Talking Heads or something with Slaughter of the Dogs. Mm. And I don't know. I'd quite like to move on from that, if you don't mind. But the tensions were building up. You know, sort of relationship tensions were building up, and you just had to appreciate the fact that the band was probably going to be move forward better without him.
Were you the person who had to tell him?
I didn't tell him. I asked him the question, and I think I've got this right because the
where do you see yourselves in 5 years?
Yes,
in
5 years' time. It's your 3 monthly assessment. Yeah. And,
Well, it was difficult. I mean, you know, the tension was in the studio. Jimmy Iovine was running around saying, for Christ's sake, can we get this effing record going here? And David was being awkward and not coming in on time and doing that anyway. It was just creating problems. And Jimmy was like, oh, for Christ's sake, get David in here, get this bloody record done and all the rest of it. So I said, well, I'm going to go and talk to him. So I talked to him and I said, you either come back to the studio and get on with it and do it and shake hands or something or whatever, or go home. He said, I'm going home.
Uh-huh.
Like, oh, Christ, okay, you're going home. That was it.
So I just want to talk about these two really key records, Making Movies,
okay.
Which I seem to remember as a huge kind of breakthrough video album. You know, Skate Away, and I went to the States at the time, and MTV had launched, and suddenly there was these really high production values videos, which I'm not sure even featured Dire Straits at all. Is that right?
You're talking about the Lester Bookbinder.
Yeah, that's what I'm talking about. Yeah.
I think that was a bit of an experiment,
right?
Because he was basically a stills photographer, and we really loved his work. And I think it was a bit of an experiment to see what he would do with these songs. And they've kind of stood the test of time. They're quite peculiar in a way. But, you know, when you have a stills photographer putting a lot of stills together in effect with a bit of movement in between, it's kind of weird. But we were in it. A little bit.
Okay.
It wasn't just all pretty girls and pretty boys. It
right.
Was, you know.
Right. And obviously Brothers in Arms is, like it or not, it's the record that people always say, well, that was the breakthrough CD. That was the record that people used.
It was
almost
a demo CD, wasn't it? I can remember when we launched Q Magazine, people would ring up and say, you've got to hear Brothers in Arms on CD, on a big player.
Yeah, yeah.
And so you were really in the right place at the right time twice there, weren't you? You were with MTV taking off and with the CD boom.
Well, that's just coincidence, to be honest. I mean, the fact of the matter is that that album was recorded on some of the very, very first digital machines, the Sony machines. I can't remember the names of them. It's too complicated for me. But these things were shipped to Air Studios in Montserrat. And I remember seeing them come up the track, being held on by 3 or 4 local blokes. They weren't even strapped down, these machines, in the back of a ute, and bouncing up the track. And they're thinking, that's not going to do those machines much good. And anyway, they worked for a bit, and then there was a problem with some tape. But so Brothers in Arms was recorded digitally, which was the first time it happened on a record, I think. And then CD came out, and Philips, which owned our record company, was developing the CD. So a lot of coincidences, and MTV was coming over to Europe. Mark wrote this song, Money for Nothing, you know, which was a view of MTV in New York when he was trying to buy a fridge. And it's true, he was trying to buy a fridge. It makes you think Mark in a shop trying to buy a fridge.
Yes, it is. I'm trying to visualise this.
These things happen.
Yeah.
So all those things came together, which created a sort of a storm, really. And you, but you've got to remember, the band up to that point had had four pretty successful records.
This is it. Yeah.
And had done a lot of touring. So it was pretty well known. And we took a long time to prepare this record. We spent a long time in a small room, you know, just sitting around working out bits and pieces. And then we went to Phil Manzanera's studio for a bit and got it a bit more organised there. So by the time we hit Montserrat, we had a pretty good idea about what it was going to sound like, you know.
And then clearly, you know, Live Aid, a bit of a peak moment for you.
Which I've forgotten that you were originally invited by Bob Geldof, unless he said this to everybody, to be the headliner. I mean, maybe that was his technique. But you were, which you couldn't do because you were playing Wembley Arena the same night.
Yeah.
Yes.
Well, he wanted us to headline it. Because, in fact, actually, at that point, I don't think Queen were thinking about doing anything, you know. Because having seen the movie now, I'm reminded of the state that the thing was in. They hadn't worked for a while together. For all sorts of reasons. And the Straits at that particular time were probably the chosen one that Bob wanted to headline it. And he used some fairly fruity language to try and get us involved, to say the least. So he didn't hold back, Bob. And we said, we just can't do it. We can't headline it. You'll have to get somebody else to do it. We can play in the afternoon. He was having real difficulty getting other people to commit to his project at that particular moment. There was, you know, because he was really pushing this idea of this Ethiopian crisis and all the rest of it. Everybody knew about it, but nobody was going to commit to this global gig that he wanted to create until they had a decent band, because they were saying, we'll wait and see who else is on it. But as soon as the Straits signed up, he said, he got people saying, yes, we'll get involved. And then, of course, Queen got together and did that extraordinary performance. Absolutely extraordinary performers.
And you were playing Wembley Arena
at
the same time. Arena.
That night, we went across to the arena and played that night. I think we had about 10 or 12 shows that were already sold out. So we wanted to honour that previous commitment. And it worked out fine, although it was quite funny when we finished our gig at the Live Aid and then walked across the car park, literally, to go back to the arena, because it's just over the way.
It seemed like a real anticlimax.
Well, the security
guy... tiny little audience.
I know, the security guy at the Wembley Arena didn't know who we were, so he wouldn't let us in. there's a certain irony there. Yeah.
So Dire Straits...
The group was in 95 that sort of dissolved, was that right?
Well, it didn't sort of dissolve, it just decided not to
play.
Just decided not to play again together.
Yeah. Yeah.
Simple, you know, but...
But you've done various things since, and you've done tours on your own, and you've bought a pub, which you occasionally put on...
I bought a pub.
Yeah, yeah.
And I've done... I've got my 8th solo album coming out in January, so...
Excellent.
So I've been quite busy doing various things. Yes, that's the pub, which I'm pleased to say is a great pleasure most of the time. But that's probably McIntosh in the middle, you know, Robbie?
Oh, yes, in McCartney's band. Oh, he's in the Pretenders, wasn't he?
That's right. Great player. Fabulous player. We had a lot of fun doing that.
And you were, you'd obviously see Mark Knopfler regularly. And but there's the two of you posing outside. Where are you there to commemorate a site in the history of the band?
That's where we lived.
Right.
This council flat down in Deptford. And somebody knocked on the door to try and so we could go and have a look inside. And the lady who lives there refused to open the door. We're all standing outside with photographers and all the rest of it. And it's nice. That, I mean, it's a nice thing to do that. And that where that the gig on the top there, that's the railway line at the back there. And our flat is pretty much where you guys are sitting.
Yeah.
And there's those two little guys at the front, and everybody says, oh, my God, that was a big audience. Well, there's more people sitting over here, right. I have to tell you. But that was, I think Squeeze played on that as well, because that's their PA system, the old WEM columns there. Do you remember those
things? Oh, yes, of course.
And
yes, you described a cable coming out of one of the flats, I think. It was all.
Well, the cable came out of our flat because I'd done something interesting to the electricity meter.
So the inevitable question is, we've got a picture of you and Martin Onfler there, is will Dire Straits ever ride again?
Oh God, I wish you hadn't asked me that. No, I don't think so. I'd be very surprised. Things have moved on since then.
Would you do that if it was
off? It's an interesting question. I don't know what it would feel like. I mean, I think it would be great in some ways, but in other ways, you know, trying to relive something, I mean, I don't know. I mean, he's very happy doing what he's doing, and I'm very happy doing what I'm doing, and we've remained friends, which to me is kind of more important than actually trying to get something else back together again. It's an inevitable question everybody asks, because I think it's probably not going to happen. Probably.
But never say never.
Never say never.
And there's the book, My Life in Dire Straits. Ladies and gentlemen, John Ilsley.
This podcast was brought to you by The Word,